Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Very special guest with us today, and we are going to focus on history. I suppose Memorial Day is a day that makes us think of our own American history, but we're going to focus on the history of the church. Our guest today is the president of Catholic Answers, Chris Cech. Hi, Chris. Thanks for being with us.
I'm very happy to be here. Very special probably overstates it.
Really? You think it'll be kind of special?
Yeah, even a very special guest. You're putting the pressure on there. Right?
Well, you're very special to me, Chris.
Yes, I appreciate that, Si. I'm starting to like you too.
Well, thanks. Thanks. That's actually really good for me. I feel that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, you're easy to work with.
Well, thanks. Let's find out if you're easy to work with.
No, actually, you could have asked the staff.
Oh, then they would have Well, they're all feeling very good about you today.
Yeah. But I
don't need to mention say why on that. Right. You're doing a great job this week. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. Well, it's week to week.
So we talk about church history. Let's maybe start with your history, if we can, for a moment. How did you become interested in history, and particularly our history as a church?
Sure. First of all, I should say I'm not really an historian. My degree from Rice University was in English literature, and I always tell people my advanced degree was in field artillery. I was a field artillery officer in the Marine Corps. But there's a convergence here. I found that literature really kind of gave an insight into the human condition in a way that I never thought that reading history did, that is reading history books or something like that. Until I started to understand that all history really is subjective. It's one man's or several men's version of events. And so when I started to look at, okay, Herodotus, this is his version of the Persian Wars, right? Or Thucydides, this is his version of the Peloponnesian Wars. And then it came alive to me. Or St. Augustine, you know, City of God, the greatest book of history ever written. You can almost smell St. Augustine when you're reading City of God. So I developed this interest in storytelling. And then it evolved largely, under the care, I should say, of my old mentor, Tom Fleming, for whom I worked at the Rockford Institute for many years. And I just started to want to tell stories that either people didn't know, and I thought that they should know, or people had one version of events that in fact was wrong. Or what are those stories in history that are turning points, that after this, things were different, right, in whatever way. And then the convergence of stories, events in history in the church, of course, because I'm a Catholic, so I'm interested in these things, and where military history sometimes collide. Well, collide is a good word.
Right.
So, you know, whatever it is, Joan of Arc or Lepanto, of course, or the Cristero War in Mexico. And those are the things that continue to capture my imagination. So whether it's setting the record straight insofar as I can, clarifying things, or where military history and church history converge.
Well, I wonder, just listening to you, how much you think or may agree with the view that would say that we Catholics, for example, don't know our history in part because it's actually been suppressed.
I totally agree with that statement. Suppressed either willfully or, you know, passively, I suppose you could say. But most Catholics are generally ignorant of their history. One of the tonics here, by the way, is the liturgical calendar, because I make this point when I give my talk on the Battle of Lepanto. There are four or five events on the liturgical calendar that celebrate military victories, and three of them are Marian feasts, including Lepanto. So someone who wants to start, a Catholic who wants to start to get back in touch with, or for the first time, come to understand his history or her history, the liturgical calendar is a great place to start. So you look at, for example, April 29 or 30, depending on which calendar you follow, the new or the old, Catherine of Siena. Hagiography, to me, I think, is always a great way to study history. And you look at the life of St. Catherine, and then suddenly all of these events in history that we've only remotely heard about, the Babylonian captivity, for example, of the papacy, right, or Avignon captivity, the subsequent Western schism that follows Catherine's death, the warring of the various city states of Tuscany in the 14th century, in the life of this magnificent diminutive dyer's daughter, who was a Dominican tertiary, all of these things come to life. So, I recommend to anybody who wants to start to get back in touch with Catholic history, look at the liturgical calendar. Find out what was happening in the life of that particular saint that we're celebrating. And the stories are fantastic.
And then you can read at least the synopsis of each saint in something like, Magnificat.
Sure.
Or if you were praying the Liturgy of the Hours, there would be the little description there.
Right.
So those can be very helpful. They can point you in the direction of what you might want to study or might want to learn more about.
Yes, there's so much good hagiography. I'll just throw out a favorite of mine because I mentioned St. Catherine. Sigurd Undset's biography of Catherine of Siena. It's my favorite work of hagiography, but as I say, it's also a lesson in, you know, the middle of 14th century Europe.
So what's if someone says to you, Chris, why study this history? Why study the history of the church?
Sure, sure. Anybody who's been in a high school history class on the first day of the year, the teacher says, he throws the standard quotes up on the chalkboard. He says, those who do not study history are doomed to relive it, right? Or past is prologue, or the great quote from Isaac Newton, if I have stood on the shoulders, excuse me, if I've seen farther than other men, it's because I have stood on the shoulders of giants. And all that's true. We need to understand our past to have a good sense of where it is we're going to repeat some of these mistakes. But what history really does for us is it tells us who we are, right? It tells us who we are, know who we are from where we came. So someone who is a student of Western Christian history understands that not only does he come from this moment or all these experiences since the incarnation, but even before the incarnation, Greece and Rome, right? I like to say that all history before the incarnation tends toward the incarnation. So you see events like the Punic Wars, right? Or the history of Alexander the Great. We can talk more about this if you want. And then all tends toward the incarnation. And then from the moment of the incarnation, all history has changed and it comes out from the incarnation. And history gives us an understanding of the incarnation, which of course it's the central moment in history. It's God directly intervening in human history. It makes your hair stand up to think about it.
But what strikes me when you say that is a fact of history.
It is.
And it is a fact.
It's a fact of human history.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's a fact that a secular historian cannot talk about.
Right.
Like we have a whole discipline of history that cannot acknowledge, for whatever reason, and maybe you could tell me what you think the reason is, cannot acknowledge the central fact of history. Therefore, there's a certain kind of falseness to all of secular telling of history.
Yeah, it's hard to know the hearts of men, but I think we can generalize safely a little bit. Once that historian has to confront the reality of God becoming man, then his whole version of events has to change as a consequence. And so he's willing to do that or he's not. And if he's not willing, then he's got to say, oh, are we even sure this fellow Jesus of Nazareth ever existed? Yeah.
Yeah, right. Right.
Because yeah. Otherwise, what is he going to do? He wait, here's a man who rose from the dead.
Yeah. Yeah. I sometimes think of that with when you think of a person like George Washington. This is on a different – but Washington felt that divine providence was involved in the American Revolution.
Sure.
But no history that tells the story from a secular perspective can agree with Washington, the guy who was there and did it. Do you see the fundamental kind of – if you can't acknowledge God in history, then history is nonsense.
It is. It is. It is. As I say, especially after the incarnation.
Yeah.
I mean, of course – I actually think, of course, the Jews had an obvious sense of this because it was revealed to them. Something was coming.
Yeah.
The Son of God was coming, right? They knew this and they had a distorted understanding of what that meant. But even the Greeks in their darkness without revelation, or the pagan Romans, for example, they all had a sense, right? Right? The whole world groaning in anticipation,
yeah.
Right? They all had a sense. They all had a sense that this was coming.
And indeed it did. So how about we do some history then when
sure,
we come back? And
absolutely.
We'll maybe start with the Age of the Martyrs.
Great.
And what we can learn from that.
Good.
Chris Check is our guest today on Catholic Answers Live, a very, very special edition where we review the history of the church and we ask ourselves what lessons can we take.
I noticed, Cy, this is the one time you let me on the show is when we're not taking callers.
Yeah. my anxiety is low. Right? We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. In a series of short, easy-to-read chapters, Trent covers the whole range of common topics, starting with why we believe in anything at all and answering all the common objections to the Catholic faith, both doctrinal and moral. Don't miss out on the most important life-changing book to come along in years. Better yet, it's only $3 a copy when you order in bulk. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
In almost any discussion of the Crusades, the Catholic Church is the bad guy. Now, in a must-read book, historian Steve Weidenkopf debunks this narrative in The Glory of the Crusades from Catholic Answers Press. Without shying away from the Crusaders' failures and even crimes, he presents a compelling case for these armed pilgrimages whose sole aim was to recover conquered Christian lands. Order it today at 888-291-8000, Catholic.com, or your Catholic bookstore.
Homeschool Connections has recently formed a partnership featuring a dual enrollment program with Franciscan University of Steubenville. Our website is homeschoolconnections.com. We are a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to a super duper special edition of Catholic Answers Live today, Memorial Day. Happy Memorial Day. It's the beginning of American summer, isn't it really? Do you feel that on Memorial Day or no?
Is that – I thought summer begins on the 22nd or something.
Yeah, of June.
The equinox. I'm channeling Jimmy Akin right now.
Yeah, but our summer, national summer.
It's true, except out here in California.
That's always summer.
With the endless summer, right? No, but out here in California, they make the kids go to school.
Yeah.
Until the middle of June or something. I mean, it's criminal.
Yeah.
And then they're starting up in August again. I mean, and frankly, school is the worst thing you could do to a child, especially a boy. you know, making him sit in that classroom for goodness sakes, heavens. Yeah.
And I wish you had been around when I was a kid. Yeah, so, because yeah. I felt the same way, but I didn't, but I couldn't articulate it.
Of course, see, I'm from the Midwest, and in Wisconsin, the great state of Wisconsin, school does not begin until after Labor Day. It's a law.
Yeah.
Clearly a Christian state.
That's right. Yeah, but that should be the law.
Yeah, exactly. Here in California, they make those children sit in school, honestly. It's awful.
Yeah, yeah, especially when, yeah, right. In the very best weather of the year, you're sitting there.
Right.
Well, we're doing church history with you today.
Somebody's going to write into the show and say, did the president of Catholic Answers say the worst thing you could do to a child to send to school?
Yes. Yeah, they are going to say that.
I stand by that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I could go on and on.
They're not learning history.
I don't want to. Yeah. Or if they are, it's a distorted.
It's a lie.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So let's talk about a little bit about the true history of the Christian faith in the early years after the maybe I don't know if you want to start with the apostolic fathers, but the apostolic fathers are roughly those people who were disciples of the disciples. And so now we're in the early history of the church. I'd like to do this in two steps with you each segment. You tell me if this will work for you. Tell us a bit about the history and tell us why it matters
sure,
to us now.
Sure.
So will you tell us about the history of the
martyrs? Sure. So when I think about the age of the martyrs, or when historians think about the age of the martyrs, they're talking about the time from, I'm going to go with the persecutions of Nero, which are sometime around 60, between 60 and 70 AD, and then ending of course, with Constantine, who declares religious liberty in the early 4th century, right? And so there's two takeaways. And we all know the stories, and some of them are what would fall into the category of pious legend. And then there are others that for which there is, good written and archaeological evidence. One of my favorite stories from the age of the martyrs is the Roman altar boy, and I'm just forgetting his name now. Somebody will think of it while they're listening. The Roman altar boy who dies defending the Eucharist from the angry mob, right? Okay, did this happen? Something like this may well have happened. We don't know. But there are others, like the martyrdom of St. Agnes, for which there is good historical record, or St. Lucy, for example, or Santa Lucia, as the Italians call her, for which there is good historical record. But what we do know is that there were a considerable number of martyrdoms beginning around mid-60s under the reign of Emperor Nero. Now, a couple of things that are important to recognize. Number one is for the first 6-7 decades of the Christian church, or 3 decades, I guess you could say, church starts with the crucifixion and resurrection, right? So the first 3 or so decades, there is kind of a – we read in the Acts of the Apostles a general tolerance of the Christian church. But then it does go bad, and it goes bad under Nero. But throughout that first 3 centuries, we see periods of persecution, but we also see periods where Rome and the Christian church are converging. And I think this is part of the story I think this is the center part of the story that most people don't know or recognize, because we kind of have a comic book version of the Age of the Martyrs. The Christians hiding in the catacombs. They didn't really hide in the catacombs. They buried people in the catacombs. They did say mass in the catacombs. That is true. But, they lived ordinary lives among the citizens of Rome. And so there are long periods of tolerance. And it's important, I think, for people to understand that Rome and the Christian church converge over these 3 centuries, culminating in the Acts of Constantine, rather than what we tend to think, the Christian church finally overthrows pagan Rome. No. A better way to describe it, I think, is the Christian church transforms pagan Rome in Christ. And so the structure of the Roman Empire is now transformed in Christ. And I think that's an understanding of the Age of the Martyrs that most folks don't have. I would recommend Giuseppe Ricciotti, R-I-C-I-O-T-T-I, Monsignor Ricciotti. Great archaeologist from two centuries ago, turn of the last century. Wrote a beautiful book, The Life of Christ, but also his book, The Age of the Martyrs. Interestingly, an archaeologist, an anthropologist of great reputation, a linguist, something of a theological liberal. But his work in history is superb. So I would recommend his work to get this good understanding. Also, Martha Sordi, an Italian scholar. Some of her stuff is in English from University of Oklahoma Press. Gives us a good understanding of this much more complex time than people think.
And how does understanding this kind of merging of you don't want to say secular, really, because it's not really secular. It's pagan religious empire.
Let me interrupt you. This is a very important point. We use the word pagan now to describe anti-Christian. Sometimes we say we live in a pagan age. Really, what we ought to say is we live in an anti-Christian age. Frankly, if we lived in a pagan age, it'd probably be better than what we're living in right now, because at least the pagans believed in something, as Cardinal Newman says, and we can come to this. We live in this age of unbelief now.
Right.
But you're right. But a pagan age and a religious age and an age in the main without the benefit of revelation, with the exception of the Jews, of course. But nonetheless, in the main, people who generally meant well and had good beliefs.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned the Punic Wars at some point. It's actually a good thing in history that Carthage was defeated by Rome. Rome was good and Carthage was bad.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought this up because, of course, we're jumping now to or back in time before the incarnation. But the outcome of the Punic Wars, and there are three of them, and it's this conflict between the young republic on the Tiber, right, Rome, that nobody's ever heard of, and then this giant commercial power, this giant naval commercial power of Carthage. And, of course, the most famous of the Punic Wars is the second, with Hannibal pretty much running havoc all up and down the Italian peninsula for almost a decade, right? And then Scipio Africanus finally defeating him on the plains of Zama in North Africa. But the outcome of the Punic Wars was who was going to control the Mediterranean.
Right.
And when we are it makes my hair stand up every time I talk about this. When we are at Mass on Christmas Eve, right, and we hear, help me out, what's
the genealogy? During the reign of.
Yes, precisely. And there are three accounts, most of these are events in scriptural history, but there are three accounts from pagan history since the such and such Olympiad or something like that.
Right.
This is setting this moment. And then what? When all the world was at peace.
Yeah.
And why? Because of the Punic Wars.
Right.
Right.
The preparation.
Yeah, exactly.
And so
And Alexander the Great is another good example of this, because had Alexander the Great not made his way throughout the East there, and we call this what? The Hellenization?
Yeah.
Yeah. So had he not Hellenized the East, and he wasn't thinking, I'm going to Hellenize.
Yeah.
In that sense, in one sense, probably he was. He was a student of Aristotle, of course, sending back plants and things. I mean, he was a botanist in addition to being a great military commander, and animals, and a zoologist, I guess you could say. But so now the Greek language is there in the East, preparing itself for what? The Gospel of John, especially, right? And now that region is prepared, that the seeds are laid for the gospel.
Right. So
you see these things going towards the incarnation and coming out. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you.
No, that's okay. It's just that I wanted to make that point, because if we take this view then that the pagan Rome becomes Christianized so that the two become identified with one another, what's the lesson for us today in our political environment? What lesson can we take from the actual history of the church in Rome?
Yeah, exactly. Always, always we should be trying to transform the culture in Christ. And sometimes we think this requires kind of like a level of activism or marches or protests or things like this. But in reality, what it means, and you look at the examples of the lives of the early Christians, we know them because they loved one another, right? And this is to me the chief example. The Romans and other pagans are astounded by the love that the Christians have for one another, right? The selflessness, which of course is not really part of pagan culture. That comes from our Lord, right? Love your enemies.
Yes, yeah, right, yeah. Right. Darkness and the church suppresses science and all of that.
Right, exactly. And this is the trope, or this is the common belief. And we can pick this up in the next segment. But we refer to this period between the fall of Rome, 476, right, and the beginning of the Renaissance, mid 1400s, as this 1,000 years when nothing happened.
Everybody went to sleep.
That's right.
Just slept in the mud.
Right. Right, right. And everyone's teeth was bad. Yeah, like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Everybody had bad teeth, and bring out your dead. Yeah. But we'll take that up in the next segment and try to clarify.
We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Professor Steve Weidenkopf, and I'm looking forward to meeting you this September 28th to 30th at Catholic Answers' 4th Annual National Apologetics Conference here in beautiful San Diego. The theme is the reunion of all Christians, and I'll be speaking on common myths about the Protestant reformers Martin Luther and John Calvin, showing you why what they wrought was not a reform, but a revolution. Make plans now to come out and join myself and my friends apologists Mark Brumley and Devin Rose, as well as all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists, at a conference that is sure to ignite and inform your faith. We need to reach out to our separated brethren in charity to bring them to the fullness of the truth. Be sure to join us for a lively and inspiring conference that will leave you equipped to do just that. Be sure to sign up early and take advantage of early bird pricing. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. In a series of short, easy-to-read chapters, Trent covers the whole range of common topics, starting with why we believe in anything at all and answering all the common objections to the Catholic faith, both doctrinal and moral. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Better yet, it's only $3 a copy when you order in bulk. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow morning on EWTN Radio, catch Women of Grace with Jeanette Benkovic. Jeanette brings you a live call-in show to simplify and amplify your life of grace. Women of Grace with Jeanette Benkovic airs weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Pacific, followed immediately by Take Two with Jerry and Debbie. And coming up right after Catholic Answers Live today, the Bishop of the Diocese of Orange, California, Most Reverend Kevin Vann, shares his faith story right here on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, is our guest this hour, and we are talking the history of the church and trying to take some lessons from it as well. So we move on from the Roman Empire to the Middle Ages.
Before we do,
yeah.
The Roman altar boy's name is Tarsicius.
Oh, that's right.
It came to me in the break. That's the way my mind functions after 50.
Yeah, I
know. It's like this, there's like this, I don't know, 30-second or... Minute.
It's less on command than it was at a younger time. It's like there's a little bit more. What's that thing called? A buffering. More buffering.
Yeah.
Where the little thing is going around.
Allegedly, I shouldn't say that. I don't want to scandalize people. Tarsicius's relics are at a church outside the Roman walls. St. Lawrence is buried there, and also Justin Martyr and Pius IX. Is buried out there as well. And I just can't remember the name of the church right now, but it was damaged by Allied
bombing in the Second World War?
Yeah, in the Second World War. There's an interesting...
Well, in the next segment, you'll remember the name of the church.
I will, I know. There's a... it might be San Lorenzo outside the walls, There's a plaque that says, you know, damaged by bombing, but it sort of tactfully neglects to say that it was Allied bombing.
we did this.
Yeah.
How about Christendom? What do you think of the word Christendom?
I think it describes the period from after the fall of Rome until the Reformation, so-called Reformation, or even a little bit of time after that, but up to the French Revolution, I'd say. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was an understanding that we were here to work out our salvation,
mm-hmm.
and that the chief duty of the political men in the political sphere was to create a world in which that was true. Now, you find under certain rulers where this is really the case. Charlemagne, for example, would be a man who strived to create a Christian world.
Mm-hmm.
Was he a perfect man? No, of course not. He had his flaws. None of these Franks or Germans, whatever you want to call them, were, you know, that far out of the woods by that point. St. Louis the Ninth, Louis the King of France, for example, is another man who maybe the best example of someone who under whose reign, middle of the 13th century,
mm-hmm.
Worked to create Christendom, right, in France. So it's a real thing. It doesn't exist anymore.
Well, it doesn't exist anymore, and it's not even called Christendom anymore. It's called the medieval period,
well,
or even the early medieval.
Right, or the Middle Ages. And I love this expression because actually I don't love it. But it's funny because we talk about the Middle Ages, this 1,000-year period from the fall of Rome, so 476 in the West, right, until the Renaissance, right, mm-hmm. sometime in the middle of the 15th century, whenever that is, early, mid-15th century. So there's this period of 1,000 years, the Middle Ages, where nothing – we're just going to call that the Middle Ages, right?
Right.
So we have the fall of Rome, right, the end of this great achievement of pagan culture, and then the beginning of the so-called Renaissance, where we go back to, right,
mm-hmm.
Greece and Rome. Right.
Yeah.
But
right.
You have 1,000 years, by the way, when the most beautiful buildings in the world that will ever be built.
Yeah.
I say with great confidence. Right. Yeah. Right. Chartres, for example, Chartres Cathedral.
Yeah.
Right. Or Rennes or Amiens or all the great cathedrals of France or England. The most beautiful buildings that will ever be built were built during this time. The liturgy comes to the fullness of its flower during this time. Right. And as there's a great book I would recommend to people. I think Ignatius Press brought it back into print a little while ago by a woman named Régine Pernod, who is France's leading historian of Joan of Arc. But she has this magnificent book called Those Horrible Middle Ages, or Those Terrible Middle Ages, I think it's called. And she just blows up myth after myth.
Yeah.
You know, the suppression of the rights of women, for example, anti-technology, anti-science, and she just knocks each one of these myths down beautifully.
But they persist because they flatter us in a way. These myths,
right?
I mean, by
they
us,
flatter
I mean,
our age,
our
exactly.
Age, yes.
Yes, we're the enlightened age.
Yeah,
yeah. We're the endarkened age because right. we've left Christ behind.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So with Christ at the center, now it is true that there's many political messes in the period of Christendom.
Just like now.
But it's also true that part of that is because it's a time of enormous political experimentation and new things are happening. And but what you have is really the first single society that's multilingual, multicultural. You know, it's from Iceland all the way to Jerusalem at a certain point.
Yes,
it's one society where it's just a mess of different kinds of people and all, but it's one society
united by
Christ.
A common liturgy,
yep.
and a common language, Latin.
Ah, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not saying that Latin was the vernacular
right.
of the day, though it certainly was spoken. It was a liturgical. It was the right. language of scholarship, and it was the Right. Obviously, the language of liturgy.
Which allows you to have things like the University of Paris, for example.
Right.
Where you can come from anywhere in the world and study at the University of Paris. You can be or you think of someone like St. Anselm, an Italian, becomes Archbishop of Canterbury in England, and nobody bats an eye.
Right.
It's all one society.
Right, right, right. It's good that you bring this up, Si, because education, as we understand it, that is the structures of education, are a creation of this so-called middle age.
Yeah.
Right. That should – so my old friend Tom Fleming and I, we used to call it the Christian age because that's what it is. Yeah.
So
we should start a movement right now.
Yes.
Stop – everyone listening, stop calling the middle ages the middle ages
or the
dark ages.
Yeah.
Start calling them the Christian age.
Right.
Because that's what it was.
Yeah. And then you mentioned Isaac Newton saying, if I see farther, it's because I stand on the shoulders of giants.
He stood on the shoulders.
Who were the giants?
Yes, exactly.
They were the scholars of the Middle Ages.
Right.
That's who he's talking
about. To be sure. Yeah.
So can we talk a little bit about Gregory for a quick minute?
Gregory the Great.
Yes.
And
his impact on the world, really. And then I want to talk about lessons from that.
Okay, sure. So Gregory the Great is Pope relatively briefly near the end of the 6th century and beginning of the 7th, if I'm not mistaken. And there's almost nothing in the structure, the liturgy, the organization, the operation of the church today that doesn't bear in some way the fingerprints of Gregory the Great. This is, by the way, another great reason to study church history. A lot of Catholics, we sort of think that this whole structure that we have with the Pope and the College of Cardinals and all these dicasteries and colleges and different things, that all this really complex bureaucracy.
Right.
And I don't mean bureaucracy there as a slur, but that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
There's Pentecost and now there's this whole structure of the church. But no, it, of course, it develops over time. And one of the things that the church does is it adopts the structure of the Roman Empire, right? And in fact, one of the places where this reality is made very clear, if you go to Rome and you look at the mosaics in the really old churches, the 5th, 6th, 7th century churches, all these mosaics are the same, the apse mosaics. They're all seen from the Apocalypse. And they show the saints, particularly the apostles, right? And what are they wearing? They're wearing, you know, the toga of the Roman senator, right? They're all wearing that toga of the Roman senator. So the church under Gregory, especially, because what's happened? The Roman Empire has collapsed. That political structure has now fallen to the barbarians. I don't know if it's politically correct to say barbarians now anymore, but that's what they were. They were barbarians.
Did you want to be politically correct?
That's not my problem. Yeah. So, and now the church is assuming not just spiritual care of the known world, but political care. And if we look at the age of Gregory the Great, one of the things that comes into focus for us, one thing we start to understand better, people say, why did it ever have lands? Why was it ever a political authority? Because now it's, you know, Vatican City States, right? Mm-hmm. After the Risorgimento in Italy, right in the middle of the 19th century, and it's confined to this little area. It's really not a political power anymore. I mean, they're observers at the UN or something like that. But there was a time when the Papal States, right, were a significant political power. Well, how did this ever come to happen? Well, somebody had to step into this vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Gregory does. This is what Gregory does. So not only the political structure of Europe under the authority of the papacy, or Christendom is better, but also structure now being given to the church. And this happens in the age of Gregory the Great.
Which would for a long time have been called the Dark Ages. I mean, really, it's very early in the period of Christendom.
And here I'm going to say, Si, not without some justification. I mean, there is a collapsing of that is the use of the word Dark Ages.
Yeah.
There is a collapsing of political structure, and you've got barbarians running around. But by the way, barbarians they weren't really interested in destroying Rome.
No.
They wanted to be Romans.
Yeah.
Yeah. They wanted to be Romans. They recognized that Rome had something that they did not have.
Right.
A level of intellectual discourse, what we would call quality of life.
Yeah.
You know, today, plumbing.
Well, many of them had been hostages to Rome and had grown up in Rome.
Yeah.
And then been returned as adults.
And they had served in the armed forces.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
So the reason I wanted to go to Gregory is because this amidst this collapse, now a new world is beginning. It involves a great deal of trial and error, really 1,000 years of trial and error. But what are the lessons that we take from Gregory and from the makers of, would you call it the Christian era or Christian?
The Christian age.
The Christian age. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll share with you the thing that is most dear to me about Gregory the Great. And it's not well known because the translations are poor. And the best one in English goes back to the 1920s. If there's a Latin scholar out there listening, because Gregory's Latin wasn't that good. It was sort of a down market Latin. But Gregory writes a book in 4 chapters called The Dialogues. I think chapter 3 is the life of Saint Benedict. So everything that we know about Benedict either comes from his rule or from Gregory the Great, all right? But the other three are Gregory's – the other three books are Gregory's deliberate attempt or deliberate effort, I should say, to create a martyrology. And in this case, I mean stories of witnesses. And this goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, the inspiration that the lives of the saints provide for us. So to create a deliberate martyrology – in an age when there were not martyrs in the strict sense of the word. So the age when, as we were talking about earlier, when people were dying in the circus of Nero, for example, not so much in the Colosseum. People think that there were a lot of martyrdoms in the Colosseum. Mostly that was for the circus. But so Gregory starts creating all these stories of holy men and women. And some of them are fantastic. And there are people, Gregory scholars, who can't believe he wrote this book because some of them are so fanciful. Mm-hmm. And here was a brilliant man, a skilled diplomat, a skilled economist, a guy who had written treatises on farming and the buying and selling of farm implements and things like this, and then had written his reflections on the Book of Job and his moral theology. But he also wrote this book for the common man. And it was wildly popular. And in fact, I think Alfred the Great, right, King of England, had it translated into English. So for centuries after Gregory, the book persisted as this handbook of how to live your life.
Right.
The stories are beautiful. Even though the translation is not so good, I encourage anybody to Google up the dialogues of Gregory the Great and read some of these fantastic stories. And there's ghosts in them. And by the way, and visions of hell and purgatory. And when you read Dante, you know he's working off of Gregory the Great.
Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, is our guest today for this Memorial Day broadcast. We'll be right back with more history of the Christian church and why it matters today when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can book any of our great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information. Summer is coming, and with it, teens, young adults, and even adult friends and family will find themselves with a lot of free time on their hands. The good news is that Catholic Answers has something to fill up that free time. 2 great graphic novels that combine visual excitement and quirky humor with philosophy and theology. The Truth Is Out There and its sequel, The Big Picture, follow 2 heroes as they travel through time and space, discovering truths about life, God, the Church, and eventually embarking on an exciting adventure along the timeline of salvation history. These books are so appealing, we guarantee if you just leave them sitting around, someone in the household will pick them up and read. And better yet, enjoy and learn from them. The Truth Is Out There and The Big Picture are also great catechetical tools for youth ministry, college classrooms, campus outreach, high school programs, RCIA, and parish family programs, and more. The Truth Is Out There and The Big Picture are available individually or packaged together at a very special price. Get yours today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or visiting a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In John 16:33, the disciples said to Jesus, "Now you are talking plainly and not in any figure of speech. Now we realize that you know everything and that you do not need to have anyone question you. Because of this, we believe that you came from God." Jesus answered, "Do you believe now? Behold, the hour is coming and has arrived when each of you will be scattered to his own home and you will leave me alone." They thought they had understood, but our Lord says, "Not so fast." He is the eternal mystery after all. We don't always feel all that comfortable with mystery. We want it all out there. Eventually, the disciples learned that trusting his love for them was quite enough. Not all of us are quite there yet. We need more time before the crucifix and the tabernacle. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Memorial Day edition. We're not taking calls because we have pre-recorded this show with our president, Chris Jack. Hi, Chris.
How are you? Sorry.
I'm well, but I'm thinking we're going to have to do this again on Labor Day because you start to just scratch and there's so much there. But
the human story is limitless.
Yeah, yeah. But what I took out of all what you said about the Christian age that struck me was the purpose of politics was a recognition that we're here to work out our salvation.
Yes,
we're working out our salvation.
Yeah, yeah. Can I give you an example there? The Inquisition tends to get a bad rap nowadays, largely because people don't understand it. And I would send them to. I have something on the website about the Inquisition at Catholic.com. Steve Weidenkopf has done very good work for us on that as well. But the only way to understand the Inquisition, or actually more correctly, Inquisitions, is to begin with the understanding that heresy not only threatened the body politic, right, was a threat to the body politic, but also to the salvation of the members thereof. So if you begin with that premise, we're trying to stop heresy because we don't want people to go to hell.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, we don't want it disrupting the harmony of
the
political
state.
Life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. Now, were there excesses? Of course. Absolutely. There's always excesses. We're all fallen, et cetera, et cetera. But if you begin with that understanding, so sorry for interrupting you.
I just want to take from that, though, what's the it made me it put a basic question in my head because we're trying to talk about the history and then the lesson for today from it. What happened to the purpose of politics? I mean, it's the purpose of politics in the era of Christendom is to make a world in which people can work out their salvation, go to heaven.
Right.
What happened?
Yeah. That? Yeah. And this is and so we're going to get one of these. Christopher Dawson-esque rapid summaries, and of course I won't even do justice. He was a genius and a historian, and I'm just a guy who likes to tell stories. But at the Reformation, at the Renaissance, beginning with the Renaissance, and then coming it more enforced during what we call the Reformation, the Protestant Rebellion, really, there is an increasing emphasis, an increasing shift of focus from the mystical body of Christ, our common call to look out for one another's salvation, to the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this in the theology of men like Calvin and Luther, for example, sola scriptura, however you read the Bible, that's your understanding of the Bible, and you're correct. If you're inspired while you're reading it, you pray, et cetera, whatever it is. So it's up to you. The institutional church and its responsibility is no longer required. Right. So there's an individual element. Well, this individualism comes to flower. Well, first we see it in the Enlightenment with the introduction of modern ideas of rights, which would be distinguished from those of the Christian age. Right. With the French Enlightenment, Rousseau, for example, especially saying anything that I desire. Because I desire it, now I have a right to it. This is Rousseau in two sentences.
Yeah.
So, but it's true. Yeah. And then, of course, so this individualism is of it, by necessity, because of what it is in its essence, now declares war on the two things that are, I'll use an expression that some people will think is communist. It's not collective, right? The state and the church. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the revolution in France declares war on the state. It declares on the monarchy.
Right.
Right. And it declares war on the church. And we've just been living with the effects of this ever since, one revolution after another, whether it's in Russia, Spain, Mexico, and even the American founding here is in no small part an odd mix of the ideas of the Enlightenment, the revolutionary ideas of the Enlightenment, and Protestant Christianity from England. I know some people don't really want to hear that, but in fact, it's true.
So,
and we talk about American exceptionalism, which is an extraordinary arrogance. Yeah.
Well, let me ask.
Unless we want to talk about our extraordinary wealth and material wealth. Yeah.
But so this expansive, self-centered individualism that the modern world proposes has a counter proposal to it in the communists, who propose a new collectivism.
Right.
And so
The suppression of the human person.
Right.
Right.
But it's a collectivism without Christ.
Two errors on the extreme. Right. And neither exactly understand Christ. G.K. Chesterton is great at this. He calls it Hudge and Gudge. Right.
I didn't know that, really. Yeah. Well, so which one are the communists, Hudge or Gudge? Because I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the Cristero Wars before we end. And that's a war. Well, I want you to put it in context. But it does seem to me that the communist idea, the new collectivist idea, absent Christ, is very present in Mexico during the time of the Mexican Revolution. And so what happened and what are the lessons we can take from the Cristero Wars?
We should say Marxist, to be specific.
Okay.
Marxist and Masonic, to be sure. And the revolution in Mexico, of course, Mexico goes through a series of revolutions beginning in the middle of the middle of the 19th century. But the one that precipitates the Cristero War is the revolution of 1917. There's a constitution in 1917, and then the subsequent war on the Catholic Church. And contained in the Mexican Constitution of 1917 are anti-clerical codes. You know, chiefly priests lost their legal identity. If you're a priest and I stole your car, you have no recourse in the Mexican courts. But generally, a suppression of the of the practice of the faith, which was the thing since Our Lady of Guadalupe, well, since Cortez, and then, of course, brought to flower with the apparitions of Tepeyac Hill, the Catholic faith is the thing that informs Mexican life. And so this direct war on the thing, it's a hard story for Americans to understand because we don't have that kind of Christianity informing our daily lives in our history. We never have. But they certainly did in Mexico. So a deliberate war on the central reality of Mexican life. There's a war that 1928, 1929, where so many magnificent men and women rise up in defense of Our Lady of Guadalupe, in defense of the Catholic faith, in defense of Christ the King. Right? Viva Cristo Rey.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm sorry. I didn't leave you enough time for this. But I have – so you just have to make a very brief answer to this. But many people now
– I'm terrible at brief answers.
No, you're all right. Hudge and fudge.
Fudge.
Now we feel some sense of oppression as Christians in the United States, given the new politics and all that. And many people look to the Cristero Wars for a kind of – I think they're taking inspiration from the Cristeros.
They should be.
Okay, so if you could just close with that. What are the lessons that
– oh, there we go.
Go ahead. You got 30 seconds.
Go learn this story. Go to Catholic.com.
And why are they a good inspiration for us?
Because these were men who were willing to lay down their lives for Christ the King. And they understood that Christ was the King of civil rulers. They understood that there was no government that did not have Christ the King at its head.
It's a dangerous idea.
Yeah. Subversive. Well, we're starting a subversive movement here, Sonny.
Yeah, we are. We are.
On Memorial Day.
Well, thanks for being with us, Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers.
What a delight.
And we expect you back for Labor Day. We really have a lot of holes to fill in.
Happy to.
And thank you so much to our listeners for joining us on Memorial Day. This is Catholic Answers Live. We'll see you tomorrow.